Welcome to the Inspiration Accelerator, hosted by Michael Sonberg, founder and CEO of Rebel Culture and Skyrocket Education. Each week, we'll talk to a different inspiring person in the world of leadership, personal development, career, family, fitness, and beyond. Buckle up for the Inspiration Accelerator.
Hey, everybody, I am here with another episode of the Inspiration Accelerator with another incredible human. I am here with the CEO of the Ready State, New York Times bestselling author of the book Built to Move. She's a former professional athlete and a person who, by her own self-report, is obsessed with helping people find ways to move more. Her name is Juliette Starrett. And she is an awesome human. Juliet, thanks for being on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
For folks listening at home, we went through this whole thing beforehand about how we're going to try to do this in one take. And then it took me three takes to get through the intro. So you won't ever hear that. But just so you know, the best laid plans. Juliet, talk to us about this idea of helping people move more. Where does this come from, and why are you so passionate about this?
Well, I guess I'll start with, I have been an athlete of some sort for most of my life, and a serious competitive athlete for also big swaths of my life. And so I think it has been sort of part of my DNA to exercise and train and move. But I know that that's not the case for a lot of people. And for many years, my husband and I owned a commercial gym. I'm also a mom who is raising two kids in a suburban neighborhood outside of San Francisco. So I have lots of friends who are busy working professionals who, you know, maybe don't have as much or at least as much perceived time and access and, you know, even financial wherewithal to be able to be exercising all the time. And I think that's really the message that has been sent out by the fitness community, is that you have to do, you know, X amount of exercise per week, otherwise you're not healthy. And while I am, of course, a gigantic fan of exercise and am a practitioner of it, I also think that we really need to expand what our definition of exercise and movement means. And I also think we really need to expand what it means to be healthy, because often I feel that those words have been sort of exclusive for people who are like passionate about fitness and health and want to talk about it at the dinner table like I do. But really, you know, movement and health and fitness is for everyone. And so, you know, my goal is to try to sort of welcome people into this conversation and help people figure out ways to move their body and incorporate, you know, mobility and better nutrition and better sleep habits into their lives, but in relatable ways. And with an eye towards understanding that people really are budget crunched, time crunched, and tired of being fire hosed with information from the internet that they can't discern. So, you know, I know that my movement practice and my lifelong sort of exercise habit has really, I think, helped me sort of live like a high performance lifestyle and really, you know, be able to succeed in my relationships and my professional life. And I really think this sort of core group of health practices, that movement being the core of that, is really why I've been able to be a successful person. And so my goal is just to expand those conversations and invite more people in to this bigger idea of health, wellness, fitness, and say, look, it's not just for this little sliver of people.
And this is fascinating, by the way. And I love what you're doing here, because it I guess it could feel like exercises for these folks. It's not for me. But it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, you're almost providing an inroad for people who aren't necessarily like you, who aren't former professional athletes. And we'll get to that in a moment. But it feels like almost exercise for lack of a better term, for regular folks, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the mistakes we've made in the health and fitness business, and I think part of this is just logistics, is that, you know, we've told everybody that fitness has to happen in 1 hour increments, because that's how long all fitness classes are, yoga classes. And I think what we forgot to tell people is, yes, that 1 hour is important, but actually the other 23 hours of your day is also important. And, you know, even if you are an exerciser listening to this, you know, the research is very clear and shows that if you exercise for an hour, but then sit for the remaining waking hours of your day, you know, you've effectively canceled out that workout. So, you know, I'm trying to invite in the people who don't relate to exercise and fitness at all and say there's lots of ways to move your body that are fun and healthy and can improve your life. And I'm also trying to say for those people who are into fitness and exercise that, you know, movement needs to be something you think about outside of your formal workout. And there's lots of healthy ways to be in constant movement throughout your day that don't require you to strap on your tennis shoes and go to a fitness class. You know, even 5 minutes can count towards the bigger picture of health. So, you know, I think there's a lot of inroads, but I'm just, you know, I'm trying to kind of, you know, upturn a lot of these ideas we have that, like, fitness means, you know, getting in my car and driving to my yoga class and, you know, all that comes with that, yes, those things are great. I'm a fan of yoga and I'm a fan of going to fitness classes, but I also think there's lots of ways we can rethink our home environments and our work environments and what it means, you know, to actually move our bodies a lot throughout the day. I mean, when I look at my grandmother who lived to be 91 years old, I mean, Grandma Georgia never exercised ever.
Right.
You know, right. But what she did do was move a lot. She walked places. She spent a lot of time in her garden. Grandma Georgia was not a couch potato, but what she also wasn't was a fitnesser. She never went to an exercise class a day in her life and, you know, lived to 91 years old and then died. And, you know, ate some bacon along the way as well, I'm sure. So, I think we can sort of look over, I do think, you know, sleep and exercise are keystone behaviors. I think we need to do those things, especially those of us who want to live long and live well. But I think there's a lot of ways to rethink how we do it, when we do it, where we do it, what it means.
This is so interesting because you're opening my mind about this. My wife and I are polar opposites when it comes to exercise. I love exercise. I know that you were on like the forefront of the CrossFit movement, and I did CrossFit for a long time. I think my shoulder, my lower back have different ideas about that to this day, but still, like, every month I do a different physical challenge every month. I love going to the gym, or I'm in the garage on the air bike before the family is awake, and I'll see like an infomercial that says, like, you know, get in great shape and only like 8 minutes a day or something like that. And I'm like, I don't want that. I don't want to work out for only 8 minutes a day. I want to work out for an hour and a half or 2 hours a day, right? Or something like that. And I want to just be moving all the time. My wife is the opposite, hates exercise, you know, doesn't go to the gym, but to your point, is moving constantly. And she decided to join me this month for my challenge this month is my friends and I we're doing a bunch of things with like push-ups and curls and things with like cold showers and stuff like that. But we're also doing this thing called the calendar club, where for each day of the month, we walk, run, or bike the corresponding miles. So I just actually got back from the gym. Today's the 5th of the month. I just did my 5 miles. You know, the 31st will be 31 miles and that type of thing. For her, she's like, I'm not going to do that. But what I am going to do is I'm going to do the calendar club for the flights of stairs in our house, which happens to be quite a lot. Not that we live in like a mansion by any means, but it's just the way it's laid out. There's like 5 separate, like, smaller flights of stairs that she is going up all the way up to the top in the the attic down to the basement. And that feels like it's part of what you're talking about there, right? Is like that she's getting the movement in a really non-traditional way.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think she's representative of a lot of people who just, you know, I'm like you, you know, I'm kind of aggro. Like I love to train hard and bleed through my eyes and lift weights. And, you know, I mean, I really enjoy that. And, you know, again, I continue to be a proponent of exercise, but I also think that this amount, the amount of total movement we get really does matter. And I think, you know, when people ask me what kind of exercise they should do, you know, my answer is always like, you should do something that you enjoy, because if you enjoy doing it, you will do it and you will get something out of it. And I think I really believe that there is something out there from a movement perspective for everyone. And in fact, as a parent, I think it's one of the most important things that you can do as a parent is expose your kids to every kind of movement tradition there is in order to encourage this physical exploration and help them find something that they enjoy doing. Because if you can help your child find a movement practice or a form of exercise that they enjoy doing as a kid, and they learn early on to feel the good feelings of what it feels like to move your body enough and get the right kind of exercise and, you know, be outdoors and whatever that means, you know, you've sort of like set the stage for a lifetime of movement. You know, in our house as parents, we always had this rule where with our kids, we always said, you know, what's not a choice is whether you move or not. What is a choice is how you move. And we're here to help support that journey. So our kids took ballet and gymnastics and jujitsu and karate and, you know, the thing where you hang from those curtains hanging in the sky and, you know, CrossFit and weightlifting. And I mean, you know, we've supported them doing all the things. And what's cool to see is that now we have a daughter who's gone off to college, you know, the true test, who loves to exercise. And she goes to the gym without being told or being asked. And she likes to go to CrossFit still. And, you know, and I really don't care what it is. If it's pickleball you're into, great. I mean, again, like there's a movement tradition for everybody. And I think we've also, and I think that same rule applies to adults. I really don't think as human beings, it's a choice whether we get to, whether we move or not. Human beings were designed to move. We have to move our bodies. And I think how we move is the only choice. And man, the sky is the limit in terms of how we can move our body. I mean, walking, hiking, pickleball, mountain biking. I mean, you know, you and I could sit here and just talk about all the ways in which you can move your body. And so, you know, what I hope is that people will, you know, people who maybe haven't had a movement practice in their life, just begin exploring and finding something they enjoy. And it, again, doesn't need to be this heroic thing where you go to a class and pay money. I mean, man, I love it. Like if your wife is enjoying climbing the stairs in your house as part of a challenge and she feels good and is enjoying doing it, like that's awesome. Like that's exactly how we should be encouraging people to think about movement in their life.
And it's to one of your earlier points, one of the things we noticed when we moved into this house, which we moved in May of 2020. So right at the beginning of the pandemic, but my wife made a comment about all the people on our block who were in their 80s and 90s, and all of the houses on our block are the same layout, you know, with a little tweaks here and there. And she's the one who came. She's like, it's because they're climbing all these steps every day. Every single day, they're climbing, you know, all these steps. And who knows? I mean, obviously, there's science to back that up. She didn't do a formal study, but it's a really, I mean, it's not hard to connect those dots, right? I mean,
it really is. Cool. I mean, my dear friend Beth's parents, she grew up in San Francisco in a like classic old Victorian house where, you know, there's probably 25 stairs just to get to the front door. And then once you're in the house itself is a three-story Victorian. And her parents lived in that house independently until they were 96 and 98 years old. And, you know, yes, of course, that's not a scientific study, but it's hard to deny that, you know, just moving, just oiling the machine is, you know, it has something to do with it. And, you know, I'd love to just tell you a quick story about this. One of the inspirations for writing our book, Built to Move, was actually my dad, who's now 81. But when he was, I think, 77 years old, so 4 or 5 years ago, Kelly and I have this background of being river guides and whitewater paddlers. And we really wanted to take our kids down a full length wilderness Grand Canyon rafting trip. It was like a bucket list item for us. And it's a 16 day trip. You're on the river for 16 days. You're camping outside for 15 nights. And it's a physically rigorous trip. The rapids are class 4 and class 5. You know, you're sleeping out in the desert. It can be 110 degrees. There's sandstorms and squalls. And then, you know, the other thing is
snakes too, right?
There's snakes and scorpions. And then, you know, I think what people don't realize about a Grand Canyon rafting trip is that one of the beauties of doing that trip is that you do tons of hiking up all these side canyons that you can only access from the river level. So you see these amazing side canyons. But those hikes are very rigorous. There's a lot of like bouldering and scrambling and climbing, and they're long. And again, it's hot. It's the desert. There's exposure. There's a lot going on. Well, I invited my dad, Warren, to join us on this trip because I thought, man, how cool, like, to be able to, you know, my husband and I, our two kids, and my dad, to be able to join. And he joined, and he was able to do everything on the trip, sleeping on the ground, you know, on a thin mat for 15 nights, getting up and down off the ground. He did all the hikes. He rafted all the rapids. You know, he did it all. And I hadn't thought much of it. But the other people on the trip were other people that were like our age, like late 40s, early 50s. And they could not stop talking about how gobsmacked they were that my dad was able to do this trip. And what they all said is, they contrasted their own parents, and they said, man, my parents could never even dream of doing this trip. No way, no how, could not do this trip. And so enough of them said this to me, and it was like enough of a thing that after the trip, I said, hey, Dad, like, what do you think it was? You know, why were you able to do this trip when none of my friends' parents could even consider doing this trip? Like, you're 77 years old. Like, how did you do this? And he said, he's a scientist by background. And he said, you know, he thought about it. And he said, well, I'm sure part of it is genetics, because, you know, he's a scientist. And he said, but I've been moving my whole life. And that was it. That really, like, that was, that story, I think, was the catalyst of the title Built to Move and writing Built to Move. Was, I thought, man, you know, again, he's gone to the gym a little bit, but mostly he's walked and hiked, and, you know, he's done different sports. He was like on a volleyball club when I was little, and he played tennis for a little while. And, you know, but I mean, I don't think he would describe himself as a real serious athlete, actually. He just likes to be outside. He's liked to move his body. He likes being in community. And so I thought to myself, man, like, we've really sort of made longevity and health and fitness like so specific and prescriptive, when in some ways I think the secret sauce may just be moving a lot in ways that we enjoy and making sure we do that consistently throughout our lives. And I think there's not a person listening to this that wouldn't think, man, like, when I'm 77 years old, to be able to go on this peak life experience with my daughter and my granddaughters, like, how cool is that? Like, who wouldn't want to aspire to be like Warren, you know? And so you didn't even ask me a question. I told you that whole story, but I just think it's cool.
No, it's unbelievably cool. And it leads me to my next question, which is, by the way, that's amazing about your dad. So I think about my dad, who's 81. Or you said your dad's 81 now?
Yeah, he's 81 now. So he's the exact same age. Yeah.
And my dad is 81, and he doesn't move at all. And he's actually in surprisingly good shape for somebody who doesn't move at all, but was never an athlete. I mean, you know, from that generation where, you know, smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day for like 40 years, and but didn't exercise, didn't play sports. And I think his lack of movement like lack of movement begats lack of movement. So now he's like 81 and doesn't do much. It's a shame. And if you contrast that with your dad and lots of other folks, well, what a different life experience to be late 70s, 80s beyond and still be very active and moving like that. And my question is like, how much harder is it now with a million TV channels and you can, you know, when people tell me they binge watch a show, like my head like almost explodes. I'm not trying to judge people, but I'm like, please don't brag about watching 12 hours of television this weekend. Like brag about doing something incredible. I'm listening. Yeah. Like that's not hard. Like that's not hard. I'm not impressed by that, but like, I'm not trying to be judgmental, but you know, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day that when we were kids, you know, like 9 a.m. on Saturday, we'd watch Saturday morning cartoons and then we were out of the house running and jumping and playing for until dinner time. And our parents had to like beg us to come inside, like that almost threatened us, like, come inside. Like it's like, it's over. And despite the fact that I am so active, like my kids, they will default. They're more interested in the tablet than they are in going outside and playing sports. It's not like it's not in them. And I would love to say that that's unique among our friends, but it's not. All the parents say similar things. How much harder is it these days to get folks to want to move?
Oh my God. I mean, you know, one of the things we really emphasize in our book is trying to rethink our environments. And by that, I mean, our home and our work environments in particular, the things we can control. To encourage more movement, because you're exactly right. I mean, you know, I was like you know, kid of the 70s and 80s. My parents didn't know where I was half the time.
Right. It's crazy to think about it now, right?
Yeah, we were just outside for hours, you know, drinking from the hose. I mean, like, we were just really like completely like the classic 70s, 80s kids. Yeah, and our kids don't have that luxury because, you know, their environment has changed and the environment has changed in the way that, you know, technology is everywhere. And in many ways, our environment is now set up to discourage movement. And, you know, I'll just give you like one piece of data. You know, when we were kids, 85% of kids walked or biked to school. And now I think it's something like 12% of kids. And I'm talking about like elementary school age kids. But it turns out that nothing has changed. The data is the same. 85% of kids live within 2 miles of their elementary school. And that data is the same as the 70s and 80s. But what's changed is everybody packs their kid in their car. And, you know, schools have invested money in drop-off lanes and everybody's driving. And it's like, well, what's changed? Well, sort of the expectations and ideas about convenience have changed. And so I do think, you know, I wish I could just snap my fingers and say, hey, there's a way to, you know, not to move more in your life. But I do think it requires some intention setting to begin with, and sort of a thought towards making sure you can add as much movement in your day, but also starting to set up your environment so that it encourages you to move without thinking. Because, you know, we're all busy and time crunched and raising kids and have jobs. And, you know, what my husband always likes to say is like, if there's cookies in the house, I'm gonna eat cookies. So we try not to have cookies in the house, right? And so look, if our whole environment is set up to be sedentary, then we're gonna be sedentary. So I'll just give you some ideas of how, like, let me try to paint a picture of how we've set up our house, for example, please, to try to be what we call a movement-rich environment. And it's not that complicated. You know, I'm sitting right now at my dining room table, but I actually have a standing workstation at home where when I'm working at home, I can stand. And underneath my standing desk, I have this cool balance tool called the Slack Block. So while I'm working, I can, you know, practice my balance and stretch my calves. If a little fly followed me throughout the day, you'd see that I stand for some of my day, sit for some of my day. I sit on the floor for some of my day. My mission is always like, what's my next position? How am I going to be constantly changing positions throughout my day? If you come in the door of our garage, we've got a home gym set up, but it's not just boring gym equipment. We have balance boards and, you know, a peg board and a pull-up bar and frisbees and balls you can throw. And, you know, we've basically put everything right there so that, and skateboards, so that, you know, the default is like, hey, let's go play our body, play with our bodies. We have a slack line set up in our backyard. You know, in our living room, we have a basket full of like every kind of mobility tool you could think about. So if you are going to binge watch a show, at least you can do a little mobility work on your body and soft tissue work. You can restore some of the positions that you've lost by sitting all the time or by doing hard workouts. And so what we've tried to do in our home environment is pretty similar to what we've done in our work environment, which is like really try to make movement and adding in little bits of movement and fidgeting and position changing throughout our day, something that we don't even think about because our environment is set up to do that. And I think that's something pretty simple a lot of your listeners could do, is rethink your environment a little bit and also rethink some of your choices. Like one of the things I do at work a lot is take walking meetings with my staff. And you know, the research is actually really interesting on this, that it turns out that we actually can listen and process information in a conversation better when we are walking side by side with someone than looking at them in the eye. And Zoom makes it even worse. I don't know what the theory is, but I think, especially when you think about Zoom, you know, when you're looking at someone, you're unable to fully listen because I think you're taking in physical cues. Zoom makes it even worse because not only can I see you, but I can see myself. So there's probably part of my brain saying, oh my God, I look tired and I look old. And right. So you're processing all this stuff. So it turns out that like you can really have a much more meaningful, deep conversation that involves listening if you're walking next to someone. And so I think it's a lot of little shifts in intention about how we work, where we work, what our home environment looks like to encourage more play and more movement. Especially like I live in a ranch house, which is completely flat. So I don't have the benefit that you guys have of like walking up and down stairs all day. So I think that there's lots of ways that I think we can try to counteract our sort of binge watching tech enabled world, but there does have to be some intentionality there. We do have to say, okay, you know, I could just go stand in your office and talk to you or sit at your, you know, guest chair and we could take this meeting, or we could just, you know, go walk around the block a few times and take this meeting and, you know, get some steps in, get some sunlight on our body, breathe some fresh air, and also, you know, possibly have a really effective and creative conversation.
This is so brilliant. And I imagine there are people, all our listeners right now are thinking about ways that they can make their homes and design their homes and even their places of work to include more movement. And your point, we take a family trip every year up to the Pocono Mountains, which is like, for folks who don't know, it's in Pennsylvania. They're a small mountain range in northern Pennsylvania. But each day we were there on this trip, we did what we called a nature walk, which is just a 0.6 mile loop from the place where we stay around the entire complex and back to that starting point. And it was like, it sounds crazy, but it was like one of my favorite things of the vacation is just getting out with the family and walking. And we talked and my kids ran ahead of us and then they stopped and waited. And it's one of those things that like, why wait for vacation to do that? We could do that all the time. And go for a nature walk in our neighborhood. I imagine there are people listening to this right now that are like, wow, like we never go for family walks, but we could totally do that.
And fun. I think that's one of the reasons why having a dog is like this ultimate healthy thing, right? Because you've got to take the dog out. But you know, one of the things that Kelly and I do every night, and you know, I appreciate, we live in California. The pushback I get on this is people are like, it's minus 20 where I live. But still people I know go outside, but we have this little walk around our neighborhood that we've calculated. It takes about 20, 25 minutes and it's about 3,500 steps, because I'm obsessed with counting steps, by the way. But it's about 3,500 steps, takes us about 25 minutes. And we've gotten in the habit of eating dinner and then taking a walk around the block. And we do it rain or shine, by the way. If it's raining or whatever, we put on our raincoats and our rain boots. We go around the block. We take our dog. Every so often, some of our neighbors join us. So we have kind of a posse of people who do this little walk. And it has so many benefits. I mean, first of all, it does always feel good to just walk after you eat. And there's research to show that you digest your food better if you take a little walk after you eat. So, you know, it's like called like a postprandial walk is the official term. You know, my husband and I have this lovely chance to sort of connect with one another without our phones, recap our day, see how we're feeling, check in with one another. Our dog gets to go outside. You know, sometimes we walk around, you know, neighbors will sort of pick up neighbors as we're walking. So we get a chance to connect with our community. And on top of that, we just get a little bit more extra movement. And it's really not that much time, you know, and I realize some people live in snowy climes, but I also know people go walking in the snow. I grew up in the snow. So, you know, it might take you 5 more minutes to get your outfit on, but man, just little walks. I mean, I encourage a lot of people to just, you know, to just rethink their meals and say, okay, like when can I fit in a little more movement in my day? And if you just add in a 10 or 15 minute walk after every meal is just par for the course. Like I ate a meal, I'm going to go for a 10 or 15 minute walk. And everybody has time for that. You can do a few 15 minute walks, even with a busy job. And man, it's just, you'd be surprised how like uplifting it is, how it's so good for your psyche, for your mental, you know, for your mental health, for your physical health. And it's really not that difficult. And again, it's like the opposite of being like, oh my God, I got to go online and sign up for my yoga class and get a spot. And then I got to make sure of my outfit and my stuff. And then I got to drive there and whatever. Right. Like again, I'm not downing yoga. I love yoga, but I'm just saying, if you look at the effort level of just walking out your door for a few 10 minute walks or the post dinner 25 minute walk, you get so much benefit from that. And it's so easy access.
This is so brilliant. I'm like loving this conversation. I have to piggyback off something you said. One of the, and you're right, some folks are in the snowy climate and sometimes it's raining. For me personally, I don't have the, I'm not an expert on this like you are, but like for me personally, my life changed when I stopped caring about what was happening outside and just went outside. And I, there were there for 40 plus years of my life, I was like, it's raining. I'm staying in. And there is something so powerful about going out and going for even a 2 mile run in pouring rain and coming back. And yes, you're sopping wet and like you might leave my clothes in the garage and it's a pool of water under them. But like, there is something so freaking rewarding about doing that and saying like, I don't care if it's raining. I am like, I'm going out in this. And in fact, my neighbor recently said, he's like, man, I saw you out in a rainstorm. I saw you jogging and I was going to pull over to pick you up and then realize that you want to be out in that. I was like, you're right. I'm like, if we were pulled over, I'd be like, no, but he was like trying to help me. But then he was like, oh, he wants to be out here in this. And what a different mindset. And I've really tried to instill that my children about like, you know, like, oh, it's raining. Like, so what? Let's go outside. Who cares? It's like nothing.
Yeah. I mean, there's this like, I think you're right. You're right. It's, there's something sort of even extra invigorating and fun about being out in bad weather, like almost brings out the kid in you a little bit because you're, you know, like you get this extra level of gratification too, because you're like, oh my God, it's like sheeting down rain. And I just went out for a jog and it's fun. And I don't know, there's something extra invigorating I find. And you know, kids don't mind it at all. Kids like it. You know, I think like you can dispel the old wives' tale that like getting wet makes you sick. You know, one of the things that I never was able to change it. And I don't know what it's like where you are. I hope it's not like this, but for some reason in our school district, our school had a policy where when it was raining, the kids were required to stay in for recess. So, you know, they would have free time, but you know, they could play games or whatever, but this drove me insane. I would go to PTA meetings and I was never able to make the case for a policy change, but this drove me insane because I was like, You know, I grew up in Colorado where it snows, and we would bring, you know, of course we walked to school because it was in the 70s and 80s, like no one drove anyone to school. So even if it was like a blizzard, we walked to school. So, and somehow we survived. So we walked to school, and then we get to school and we take off our whole outer layer, all our snow clothes and boots, and hang them on a hook. And then when recess came, we would put them back on and go outside in the snow. And it was a blast. We sledded and had snowball fights, and like, we loved it. Right. And so it was so crazy to me that I was in this climate in Northern California where the worst weather we have is rain and the kids aren't allowed to go outside for recess, you know? And I was like, man, how about just require all the kids to bring some rain boots or have some rain boots around, or, you know, whatever. But, you know, so, you know, I agree. I think there's something so wonderful and human and invigorating about being outside in inclement weather. There's this amazing invention called Gore-Tex, which really does work well, keep us dry. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think just that, and what I love about what you said is that if you even remember what prompted it, but it was like a decision you made or a slight shift in your intention where you'd been, you know, stuck in a rut doing and thinking about something one way, and you just shifted your intention slightly and it opened up this whole wide world to you of something, you know, the outdoors that you felt that you couldn't access before because of bad weather. And like, how cool is that? You know, and that's what I'm hoping I can help people do, is just make these minor shifts in their perception and intention about what it means to move, what it means to be healthy, because just those minor, I think literally those minor shifts we make in, you know, small choices, small shifts in intention, small perception changes can really have these vast benefits to us from a health perspective.
So amazing. Absolutely loving this. I just, a quick aside about the walking to school thing. I currently live about five towns away from where I grew up, and I happened to be in, which I never thought was going to happen in a million years, but my wife had different ideas about going back to where we're from. And I happened to be in my hometown recently, and I'm rarely there, but I happened to be in my hometown, and I wasn't too far from my elementary school. And I had this moment where I was like, I used to, and when I grew up, there were walkers and there were bussers. I imagine it's the same term now. I've never heard anyone use that, but, and I work, I do a lot of work in schools, so I can't believe I don't know that term, but I was a walker and I was really far from my elementary school, like really far, like way much, way further than my kids are to their elementary school now. And they get a bus. And so to your earlier data, I think you said that something like 85% walked and now it's 12% or something like that. It's really crazy because that's every single day for years of additional exercise, additional movement. And our friends would meet up with us and we'd run and we'd play, and, you know, kids play on the bus, but it's a lot different, right? Obviously. And so if you multiply that by all the different things now, we watched Saturday morning cartoons when they were on. And if you missed it,
that's it. Stream them later. Yeah. You had to get it. Yeah.
It was over.
I started this thing when my kids were in elementary school called the walking school bus, because we were walking to school as a family. And I remember even then being kind of dumbfounded because I was like, man, like the neighborhood that I live in, it feels like the 1950s Pleasantville. Like there's all these mid-century modern houses. And when you're in it, you're literally like, it almost feels like a throwback in time. And I thought to myself, man, I live in this crazy neighborhood that could not be more like the perfect description of the suburbs. And yet we're the only people walking with our kids to school. I thought it was really weird. You know, we had these lovely experiences as a family, kind of like the family walk thing. You know, we started walking when our kids were little. And then, you know, when our younger daughter joined, she walked with us. And for us, it was like a mile and a half to school. And I think it was like 2,500 steps or 3,000 steps for our kids. But what was cool about it is that we didn't have to pack our kids in the car. We weren't rushed. We didn't deal with traffic. We didn't deal with the drop-off lane. We were able to walk into the school through the back way. So we walked across this field. And it was this lovely way for us and for our kids to start our day. You know, they got their sort of like, you know, teachers like to say, get like your wiggles out or whatever. They got a little physical activity, which I think put them in a better mental state to be ready to learn. You know, Kelly and I would walk to and from school. So, you know, by the time we went off to work, we were like, dude, score, we've gotten 6,000 steps already, like easy peasy. Right. And we spent quality time with our kids and whatever. So, I decided to start this thing called the walking school bus. And I put a flyer out at the school and I said, every single day, rain or shine, Monday through Friday, we will be standing at this corner and you are welcome to lead your kid and we will make sure they get to school safely. And it was such a cool thing. I mean, and we made friends with parents we wouldn't know. We met kids we didn't know. You know, some days we'd have 40 kids, some days we'd have 3 kids. You know, but we were able to shepherd all these kids to school for years and years and years and sort of take away that fear, which is an irrational fear, but I get it as a parent that your kid's gonna get kidnapped or something on your way to school. Knowing that they're with a group and they're safe and somebody actually sees them walk in the door of school. And it was just such a lovely experience. And I had a few people say to me over the years, well, I mean, I would love to participate in the walking school bus, but I work. And I would have to be really careful to correct them and say, I work as well, full time, in fact, Uber full time. And I'm able to do this, you know, this walking my kid to and from school was a half an hour a day. To and from, and I still was able to get to work on time and work a full day and in front of my computer. And, you know, so again, I think, and you know what, speaking of this intention shift, you know, when we decided, we started off our daughter in kindergarten, dropping her off in the drop off lane, and pretty early realized we were like, oh, this is like, feels weird. It's not for us. So the sole change we made in our household that this sort of what we're talking about, this sort of mini shift in logistics and intention, was we set our alarms 10 minutes earlier. So the only thing we did in our household to facilitate this gigantically amazing interaction experience with our kids and physical activity in our community was setting our alarm 10 minutes early. That's all we had to do. We just realized if we got up at 6:35 versus 6:45, that gave us enough time to get our kids ready for school, to get ourselves ready and be out the door to meet the walking school bus by 7:55 and, you know, shuttle our kids and all these other kids to school. And Kelly and I would be home by like 8:25 and at work by 9 a.m. No problem. Right. And so you know, I think sometimes people think, oh my God, like my mornings are chaotic and I there's no way I could fit in walking because they think it's going to take more time. But it turns out this tiny little shift in behavior and intention of waking up 10 minutes early, just like the way you decided you could go outside and weather, tiny little shift in intention and logistics can have a massive difference on so many parts of your health.
What a great point. And I'm thinking about all the different ways that I can incorporate more, even more movement in my life, but I'm thinking about my kids' lives as well. And this is so unbelievably cool. Talk to us, and I know we're getting close to time here, but talk to us about the whitewater rafting. You're like a world champion whitewater rafter, right?
Yes. And I'll say for those people who've never heard of the sport, you're not alone. It's a very fringe sport, extremely fringe. Although I will say in the US, it's extreme. It's actually like a big sport around the world. And so it's there was some talk about having it be an exhibition sport in the Olympics. So it's always kind of flirting with legitimacy, I would say, in sort of the big competition. So but yeah, I was a river guide. I was a Division I rower in college. And I just happened to try out for this obscure sport that is competitive whitewater rafting. And I made a team in 1997. And then, you know, it really changed my life. I dedicated myself to, you know, being a professional athlete for 5 years. And I competed in 5 world championship level events, 1, 2, got second place in 3. And that's actually how I met my husband, Kelly. He was competing in the same sport in 2000. And we met in the mountains of Patagonia, Chile in the year 2000. Wow. So that was a bonus. That was an extra bonus, was meeting my, you know, lifelong partner and spouse. Yeah. So that was cool. But, you know, it was, there were a couple of things about it that were really spectacular. I mean, the first was that you know, to be able to have to understand what it means to be a professional athlete, especially one that has no money, really, you know, very little sponsorship, and try to figure out how to make your way. And also try to figure out how to, you know, be your best athletically without a lot of additional support. You know, we didn't have massage therapists and nutritionists, and, you know, we were just a complete DIY team, you know, in every possible way. But the other thing that was so special is that I got this opportunity to travel. I mean, all these events were all over the world, and I got to travel, you know, to Africa twice, and South America and Central America and Europe, and, you know, interact with all these international teams. And it just was this really formative experience for me. And also did really give me an eye into what it's like to be a serious athlete and a professional athlete. And, you know, in our early career, Kelly and I were really focused. If, you know, if you'd done this interview with me in 2014, what I cared about even then was, you know, how do we make the best athletes in the world better? That was my focus. You know, how can I be awesome? How can I make the best athletes in the world better? And I do still care about that. And we still do a lot of work with professional athletes and teams in the human performance space. And we still are always trying to see how we can help those athletes move the needle, you know, in terms of performance. And we do care about that. But as I've aged and gotten older, and, you know, after owning a commercial gym for many years, you know, my focus and Kelly's focus has really shifted to be like, hey, how do we bring more people into this conversation? How do we take the lessons that we've learned trying to make the best better and scale those down to everybody else? Because again, you know, health is for everyone. It should be for everyone. And I think there's ways that even in this tech-enabled, you know, sedentary driven, you know, crazy world we live in, there's a lot of ways to make movement fun and part of your life, and make health fun and eating together fun, and, you know, sort of incorporate all these practices in your life in a way that's not a drag. And I do think it's possible.
So brilliant. Oh, this is amazing. I want to share one story with you, of course, but with the folks listening at home, just about this idea of you mentioned this earlier on the call, like finding the thing your kids were in this sport and that sport, and the thing you referred to, like the things hanging from the ceiling, which I don't know what those things are called, but my oldest, Max, is he's 10. And, you know, not very interested in sports, not very interested in athletics, which has been a little bit of a challenge for me. I want him to be happy first and foremost, but I also, you know, I want to see him out there doing some stuff. And he's, you know, I he's a pretty good swimmer. I asked him if he wanted to be on the swim team. He said, no. We put him in a baseball camp at the end of the week. We asked, like, how was baseball? He said, on a scale of 1 to 10, it was -21. You know, kids across the street are playing basketball. I ask if he wants to go over and play with them. He's not interested. On that same trip I mentioned earlier on the call, we had him try snowboarding. And within 5 minutes, it was like, this guy is a natural. And he's also got like the cool snowboarding hair. And so he's just kind of going down the slopes. He learned how to snowboard in like 15 minutes. And I said to my wife, I said, I live on Long Island where there were no mountains near us, but it's 2 hours away. I said, I will drive here. You know, we're going to get the equipment. The winter season's almost over out here, but like next year I will drive here. I will do day trips with him, whatever he wants. If he's passionate about this, if he likes this, great. And
that story, because, you know, what I love is that you didn't, I think the initial instinct for a lot of people would be to give up and just say, oh, well, my kid's not athletic, or, oh, my kid, right? I think that might be an initial impact of a lot of parents. And I really would push back on that. I really believe it doesn't matter if, you know, because the other thing I see is there's parents of a lot of kids I know who like, you know, parents seem to bucket their kids as either athletic or creatives. And then there's this idea that the creative kids, well, they're creative. So they play the violin, or they're artists, or in a band or whatever. So those kids, the creatives, don't need to move. Well, not true. Unfortunately, if you have got a body, you need to move it around. And so what I love about your story was that you just didn't sort of say, okay, well, it'd be easy for me to just write off my kid as a creative kid who doesn't want to be athletic and doesn't want to do anything. But I really do love that you just kept experimenting and experimenting and experimenting until you found some way of moving his body that he enjoyed. And I really believe that every kid, you know, and again, I realize, you know, we're coming from a privileged point of view where we have the opportunity to take our kids to try all these things. And not everybody has those opportunities. I want to acknowledge that. But I do still think there's lots of free ways to move our bodies that, that, you know, again, I think if kids are presented with many options, they're going to find some way of moving their body that they enjoy. And I love that you just persisted in trying to find a thing that he loved. And that's so cool.
Well, I couldn't get a better compliment from somebody who's dedicated their life to this. So, Juliet, thank you so much. Where can folks follow you, find you on social media? I'm assuming if you have a New York Times bestseller, they can get the book anywhere. But give us some info where folks can learn more about you.
Sure. The main place I am on social media is Instagram. I'm at Juliet Starrett on Instagram. Our website is called TheReadyState.com. We also have a podcast called The Ready State Podcast, which people can find anywhere. And then our book, Built to Move, is available on Amazon as well as every other retailer. And you can learn more about the book at BuiltToMove.com.
Amazing, 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 amazing. Juliet, thank you so much for coming on. It was incredible to learn from you. And I hope everybody out there listening is thinking of ways to move. I know that I'm going to get off this call and drop down and start doing some push-ups. So thanks for the inspiration. Thanks for everything you're doing for all of us. And I hope we get to connect again soon.
Thank you again so much for having me. It was so fun to chat.
Awesome, awesome. Well, everybody, we'll see you next time on a new episode of the Inspiration Accelerator. And have a great week or two, and try and move. All right, everyone. See you. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode. Please look out for a new episode with a new guest every week. This was the Inspiration Accelerator with Michael Sonberg.